Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
All right, we have a special. Try that again. We have a special live stream tonight. Without further ado, let's welcome Dr. M. David Litwa to the stage.
Hello. Hello, friend. How is everything? Good to see you.
Cheers to you, this magical Cheers. Hermetic night. Well done.
Wow, and it is a late night.
9:45 on the West Coast, so it's past midnight on the East Coast. So this is for this few special hardcore people who want to enjoy a glass of wine with us and hear about your great work and my very small contribution to it, and have a little fun and talk about Hermetica.
Oh no, you had a great contribution. In fact, I already have a witness from someone who got the Audible version of Hermetica One, and they loved your passion. And in fact, I really think that's what makes your reading so important, that I designed the book for practitioners. And so it's really important for someone who truly, sincerely loves and believes the material on some level to actually be the one voicing it, because that's so appropriate. And is obviously, you know, miles and miles and miles away from having some virtual voice to it, and is miles and miles away from, you know, just some random person trying to make money on Audible. You know, like, you have done an amazing job. And so that's what we're celebrating here.
You know, as I thank you. And as I started, you know, it takes me back to the beginning of COVID and when I started the podcast, and I knew I never expected to be necessarily a good podcaster. I never thought this was my forte, but what else were we going to do during lockdown, eh? And along the way, I knew I was developing some skills that would one day be useful. And when I was doing the Audible recording for Hermetica One, which I have right here, and I, of course, I also have the proto version of that, the very thin, smaller one. So there's a secret proto version, which probably maybe only a couple people have. And as I was doing it, I was like, this is why I started the podcast, so that I would have the skill set to be able to take on this text and do it justice. That's what I was thinking the entire time, the last few months recording it, was that this was the whole reason I started the podcast, was to so I could have the chops to pull this off. So thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for letting me give it a shot, because professional audiobooks are not the same as babbling into an iPhone and then throwing it up on Spotify. It's a little bit different, as we discovered, as we're still discovering.
As I said, I think I've had many people. So I have, I think, like 10 books on Audible, and yeah, you're far and away the best to, I mean, I've had people turn in productions that were like full of mistakes. I even heard them like swearing under their breath and like other things, like pauses and weird outbursts and like husky breathing. I mean, honestly, I've seen it all. So,
wow.
I mean, you really know sound, and it really comes through. I mean, much better than I do. I have tried to do my own audiobooks, and I have never ever been satisfied with the product. It's just, ugh, I hate it. But yeah, so you have really saved my life.
Well, thank you. I mean, I burned through almost 400 podcast episodes to learn to improve the speaking, because music is easy for me because I've been a musician so long. But speaking is a different thing. Like I learned to love my voice singing because I got good at doing it. But speaking is still challenging to love your voice, and you have to really use the diaphragm. There's all I could talk for ages on how the different postures I use for different parts of the text and the different breathing methods. You know, I would have producers as a musician who would actually call me out of the recording room, and they'd point to where on my body, down the spine or down the central column of my body, they wanted me to sing the next part of the song from, because I could focus on that part of my body and it would give a different timbre that they could identify, and they would actually, so that was good training. But you know, I know sound, and you know Greek, so I'm enjoying also your Greek courses at the moment.
Oh, excellent.
So don't feel bad if feel bad if you don't know sound, any other things. And I'd love people to know exactly what went into writing a Hermetica, because it is more interesting. The content of what you have created is more interesting than the details of the pop screen, pop filter I used, and the Mogami cables, or the details that we had to spend a lot of time talking about, or we did spend a lot of time. So, and I did notice there's a few plosives on the recording. I'm like, oh, even when you think you got away with it, there's still one or two plosives, like, you know, there.
Yeah.
Such is life.
Well, yeah. So, so Hermetica One is, we're always trying to improve on our predecessors and bring in the most recent insights. I guess the biggest insight that I bring to the table, or at least I hope to bring, is something which is also imminently revisable, and I'm sure that people in the future will try to revise as well. But I've taken, I think, the Hermetic text seriously as constructing a path of initiation. And so the traditional order of the 17 tractates, which didn't include things like the discourse on the 8th and 9th and the Nag Hammadi stuff, I think is problematic. It's like when you read Copenhaver, even if one thought that Copenhaver was like the best translation, it's still, that order is almost meaningless. And the Hermetic texts themselves are very clear that they're wanting to bring an order of initiation. They are initiatory texts. And, you know, Richard Reichenstein talked about laissez mysterium, you know, that reading them itself was the act of initiation, that you are initiating yourself. And inside the text are little notes about the order. So Hermes will say offhandedly, you know, as I said in the general discourses, and, you know, Tot will say, Father, you gave me this detailed discourse. And the discourse on the 8th and 9th, or as I call it, the 8th reveals the 9th, that talks about literally bathmi, which is the Greek word for steps of initiation. And it's very clear that in Corpus Hermeticum 13, the discourse on rebirth, Tot is thinking in terms of steps. He's like, I have alienated myself from the world. I've taken the initial step. And in the 8th reveals the 9th, he's like, I've read all the necessary books. I've done all the necessary study. I've gone through the whole progression. And so they're very much thinking that of this as initiation. Now, I mean, if you were playing the devil's advocate, or you wanted to be a super skeptic and wanted to say, well, that's just the Hermetic fiction that these writers are trying to create, obviously you can take that route. But I think the great advance of scholarship that we're seeing since Garth Fouden, with Fouden, with Wouter Hanegraaff, and with Christian Bull, and with Jean-Pierre Mihai in France, is those are like the four titans of Hermetic scholarship that have all recognized this is about an initiation. And so why in the world are we still reading the texts in a random order when we can present them as a path of initiation? So that's what I've tried. And obviously when people pick up the text, you know, I'm not saying that I have some sort of inspiration from Hermes, you know, but what I am saying is that I'm giving you what I think is a logical progression in terms of the way that the texts construct themselves. So I divide it into introductory texts, general discourses, detailed discourses, and revelatory discourses. And obviously, by the time you get to the revelatory discourses, you know, that's where you're becoming nous. You know, you're totally out of this world, and you're in the upper spheres, in literally in the eighth realm, in the ninth realm. That's like the height. And then at the end, I have an appendix. And that is Corpus Hermeticum 18. It's interesting that Solomon.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
18.
He never even translated that one. And I think, yeah, it's the one on music and the praise of kings. And the reason why that one, yeah, Clement, yeah, it, the reason why he didn't translate that is because he just thought that that's just not hermetic. And I agree with him for one simple reason, that is that the text never says that it is in any way related to Hermes. And there's no hermetic speakers. That's not to say that one might not get some kind of insight or hermetic insight from the text, but I leave that up to the reader. In other words, I'm not going to place that in the progression because I'm not sure that is a hermetic text. So I feel like I don't have the rights to kind of push that one in there, but I'm not excluding it either. And I'm not just ignoring it. So that's the main contribution.
Yeah, you bring, of course, that's the quandary that I think Umberto Eco addresses in Interpretation and Overinterpretation and the role of the reader, right? There's this fine line, and that's where appendices are wonderful. You can just put it in the end. It's like, does it seem hermetic or not? You can almost be an invitation to the reader of the text to suss it out in their own experience. And there was parts of it that resonated very true for me, which is why I say this, and parts that kind of, you know? There was a few bits there. I was like, oof, that doesn't feel in sync with everything I've read before it. But there was parts that really did. I mean, there's parts about music, and then there's a lot about kingship. So that I look forward to hearing what the consensus of your readers is on that appendix of the text. Now, do you think if a hermetist, an ancient hermetist, was able to be a fly on the wall of all the work you've done on the hermetic text, I'm curious what you think they might think and whether they would appreciate the fact that, you know, assuming they had a full understanding, a full a noetic understanding of our entire time and place and context, right? So a complete fusion of hermeneutic horizons, even though they're just a little spirit on the wall watching you work and put out this arrangement of the text for initiation. Do you think they would see it as a... at the very least, wouldn't they see it as this scholar, you, opening yourself up to your own higher consciousness, whether you believe in it or not, to achieve that end of the arrangement of the texts in your new, and you did new translations too, which is important for people to know.
Well, I hope so. And that's really the second contribution, that after each text I translate, I give what I call a spiritual commentary, meaning, you know, I introduce like the historical, some historical and literary background, but my intent there, again, the book is not for academics. The book is for practitioners. Academics can use it. And you know, maybe they should.
Hopefully will.
But in the end, it's for practitioners. So I write the commentary for them. And I hope that whether it's an ancient hermetist or a modern hermeticist, you know, they might disagree with me on the order, but I think that both would agree that it's a useful project to think in terms of initiatory steps. So, you know, if you're reading it and you're like, well, I think that, you know, Corpus Hermeticum 5 should be somewhere else in the sequence, my attitude is totally fine. I mean, yeah, that was never the most important thing, you know, like, I'm not saying that I'm actually reconstructing something ancient. No, I'm just giving, after years of experience with the text, I'm just giving my sense of, you know, this is a general discourse, you know, or this is a detailed discourse, and this is what the texts are saying about themselves. There are cases where really nothing is said. And you know, then it is educated guesswork. Again, I never claim to do anything more than that. And it's useful to, you know, to do that educated guesswork in a community where people will obviously disagree. But what I hope we can agree about, if you are a practitioner, is that we should be trying to put it in the most, I won't say logical, but you know, the order that represents a logic of initiation.
Yeah, I definitely had an initiatory experience doing the text, reading it and recording it, that I was surprised by, because I've been reading that text since I was a teenager with the Divine Pymander, as the version I had called it in my little, it was a little hardcover book. I'm sure some people out there have the same one. And I could tell as a teenager in the 90s that there was some translation issues with the text from the way it was phrased sometimes. I could tell that there was, but worse than that, a general overall understanding of it was pretty much impenetrable to me. I could take sections of it and apply it to what I was learning and experiencing in my other hermetic training in the Order of the Golden Dawn and other systems. And even some of it even made sense in the yogic systems of my upbringing. So there was a lot of stuff that related to other things. But for example, I want to give people some exciting things since they're staying up late listening to us celebrate our accomplishment. And it feels wrong to say hour there, but I'll take it. Thank you. it was a lot of work. When I first took it on, I was like, it's probably 30,000 words, right? That's it. Like, no, it was 65,000 words. And fair play. And the font is really nice. By the way, it's formatted, people, for easy reading. So you could start a hermetic church and make this your hermetic liturgy and just read from it each week on your gatherings out in the forest in nature, because hermeticists probably did their worship in nature, right? Not necessarily indoors, as was also thought till recently, I think. But most salient was the go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, they'd like to see the sun rising and setting.
Yeah. Outdoors. So it's almost like a proto-Egyptian druidry. if you forgive the conflation. But one thing I really was impressed by was understanding that the noose is a daimon. Is that and so we are, because when we get initiated into our higher consciousness, our noose, that's when we access this holy daimon, so to speak, that is a part of us but different from our soul, but something that we can unite with through initiation, and that this brings us to immortality. And so we're uniting with, it's like our soul, but our soul and the daimon aren't two separate beings, really, are they? And what is different, how is that daimon of ours different from other daimons like star gods and angels? Maybe you could speak to a bit of this, because this is the kind of stuff that really I know my audience is very curious about. And very few writers before you and Bull, and well, I think Wildeberg will be the big new addition to the literature. Again, it's something people aren't very clear on, so I'm sure people would love to hear about. How are we daimons? How are we like star gods? How are we dying gods? How are we different from angels? And what do we have to do to access that higher consciousness? Because it's not as gatekept as I think people might have thought it would be.
Hmm. Yeah, well, everyone had to deal with that passage in Plato in the Timaeus 90a, which even Plato recognized that the nous isn't fully innate, that it is, he called it a synoikos, a roommate, or something that dwelled in you. And that is your new. So it's not fully, it's certainly not fully fused with your ego, what we would call your ego, or that frontal cortex version of you. It is definitely a higher self. Plutarch likened it to a buoy, which floats, if you imagine your upper consciousness, your higher consciousness, as above your head, literally. It's like you're underwater, but your daimon or your noose/daimon is floating like a buoy above your normal consciousness. So they're definitely aware that it's not, you know, the thing that you normally call me when you walk to the grocery store. Hermetists, I would say, like I say with almost everything hermetic, they don't have a single doctrine. They just don't. They're not very consistent. The treatises, it would be impossible to do a systematic theology. And believe me, the Germans have tried. But, you know, I would say this, that they certainly recognized that the noose was something much higher than mind. And that is, I guess, the major problem with Copenhauer's translation of, he always translates noose as mind, which could be mistaken for your rational mind. And it's definitely not that. It's something higher. So I opted for higher consciousness. And it is true that Neoplatonists more and more identify the noose with your resident daimon. And Hermetists, I actually don't see them doing that a lot. They like to talk about daimones that are much higher than we are. But in a sense, the stuff of daimones, it's still noetic. That is, it's still, their bodies are made of thought. Their bodies are made of whatever consciousness is. That's what a daimon is. But they are ranged below the sun. There's a lot of interest among Hermetists of identifying daimones with the Decans. They are higher beings who are controlling fate and taking care of us, is primarily the Hermetic focus. And they are our guardians, and they do cause mischief. So they can be blamed for natural disasters too. I think that our destiny is, Hermetists don't say this exactly, but our destiny is very much to become a daimon when our noose is finally, you know, then they cut the line to the buoy and everything, you know, takes off. I think essentially, yeah, the noose just is a daimon in the lower air, and you get some kind of fiery body, and you
the
just
tunic
soar
of fire. Apart.
Yeah. And that's your next stage in your evolution, your spiritual evolution. I talk a lot more about this in a book called Post-Human Transformation in the Ancient Mediterranean. And I try to put it in a larger context.
It's the first book of yours I bought, obviously, from the title. The cover's pretty groovy as well, honestly. Pretty groovy cover there. Whoever published it, well done. But it's a short little book, comparatively. And I love that book. Absolutely. You take on, you know, aside from the fact that you delineate nuances such as angelomorphism versus theosis, for example. That's very interesting, and I think my audience would be curious about that. That's a good place for people to start. But you also address some of the moral and ethical issues in the entire point of view of seeing ourselves as post-human or beings that can develop in certain spiritual or even technological ways, right? You take on a lot of different things. So that's a really, I'd love to deep dive into that with you sometime, but let's, to bring it back to the Hermetica. So you do address that stuff. So not everyone in the Hermetica is initiated. It seems that there's, and the question is, what happens to the soul? Like, the soul is either carried up with the noose, the holy daimon, upon death and into the upper realms of reality, into a new life, or what happens to the souls that don't achieve higher consciousness? Do their souls just disintegrate into nature and get reborn that way, or do they, what's your take on that? Because it's very it's in contradistinction to a lot of Gnostic views, which again are very hard to discuss in general, but a lot of Gnostic views, prison planet ideas, you know, the idea that we're stuck in a cycle of reincarnation until we get it right. How are the Hermetists different from those sort of Gnostic views?
Well, I mean, they're different and they're not different. So Hermetists are big believers in reincarnation. They're very consistent, actually, not totally consistent, but fairly consistent on the transmigration, that you will get another try, but that re-entering into your wet platform, as I like to call it, your flesh, that's a punishment. So that's very Pythagorean, where they view that as an extra trial, you know, another time to go through the cycle to get purified. But yeah, you're supposed to enter a dry platform, but presumably, yeah, that might take a while. But I haven't seen in the Hermetica any idea of soul annihilation.
They were describing at some points, like, it did seem at certain points, I'm like, are they really saying that some souls just sort of become reformed into the matrix of matter and reality, but don't really retain their distinction anymore? It did feel like that at certain points in the text. And I would have made notes as to where those points were so we could discuss them. But of course, I was trying to get the book done for Audible, so I just kept going. But many things crossed my mind in those many hours of recording. So yeah. Anyway, I thought that was one thing I wanted to hear a little clarification on. So in your reading, because you know the text better than anyone, yeah, it's always reincarnation. It's not like soul destruction if people are too lazy to bother accessing their higher consciousness. It's not like game over, you know. It's, yeah, you get to keep going. And the text makes it very clear we don't become animals or other life forms, because that would be a punishment and a degradation of what it is to have a human soul. So that's very, very distinct in the text.
So there's a point of disagreement, though, because the Hermetists don't agree with themselves. So if you read the Kori Kosmu, there's a speech of God in the Kori Kosmu where God clearly says that, okay, if you continue on the path of disobedience and of error, I will put you in an animal body. And so that is like much more punishment, right? But in the Corpus
Hermeticum 10. But that's not in this book. Yeah.
Yeah. No. 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 And in the Corpus Hermeticum 10.
That's in the sequel, which you wrote first, in true George Lukean fashion.
I wrote them out of order. Yeah. So the Hermetists disagree. Yeah. I think more and more as you go into late antiquity, people who believe in reincarnation, Platonists mainly, they are less and less willing to believe in animal reincarnation. That's more like the ancient Pythagorean stuff. That's like Empedocles, who is like, I was a boy and a bird and a bush. But more and more as you get into late antiquity, they're not willing to go there. So it's not surprising to me that Hermetists would disagree on that particular point. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Because there's a precedent for that. Another one of the biggest revelations studying your work on the Hermetica and again reading Christian Bull finally and Ebeling, The Secret History of Termes Trismegistus, which has a wonderful foreword by a man with the awesomest name of all time, Jan Osman. So I had to say it. I've been giddy to get that on the tell people. Anyway, where was I going with that? Sorry. They were very interfaith, it seems. They didn't mind if you, they were interfaith. Is that fair to say that they were an early syncretic interfaith movement?
Well, I would say for them, they are trying to promote their own Egyptian identity and specifically their own Egyptian religious identity. I think that they make no question that they know about the Greeks. They consider Greek wisdom to be derivative. They consider it to be not the love of the love of wisdom, but the love of noise. So they are critical of that. But obviously, you know, there's both conscious and unconscious syncretism, right? So you can be very syncretic and yet say that you're not syncretic at all, right? I mean, that's a common kind of a thing, like, because, you know, mixture is about purity. So you can say, oh, well, we're representing the pure and historic Egyptian religion, while at the same time, you know, taking in all these other features. The great example of this is Corpus Hermeticum 16, where Asclepius says, first of all, that his discourse is going to contradict everything he previously said. But then his second point is that I'm expressing this in the Egyptian language, where words actually don't have meanings. They actually do what they do based on the sounds. The words themselves have the power. And if you were ever to translate this into Greek, it would utterly make the language paralyzed, like flaccid and useless. And yet that author is presumably writing in Greek. So, so I mean, there's that, there's that sense where they're very Egyptocentric, right? And you see that in the Hermetic Asclepius, in the so-called Apocalypse, where that famous passage where it's like, oh, Egypt, Egypt, you know, you have been destroyed. And it's like the gods have departed. And basically, it's the fault of the Greeks and Romans. And it's the great lament of the colonized against those forces. But of course, to be heard and to have access to that Hellenistic world, they spoke in Greek. They read Greek philosophy, they interacted with all sorts of Greek and Roman ideas. So clearly, you know, they were walking a fine line.
We just have to acknowledge this fellow who is familiar with Jan Assmann's work. Congratulations on the audiobook. Thank you very much. Yes, that is not actually how his name is spelled. There's two N's. There's two N's in his name, but I appreciate the tongue-in-cheek removal of the second N. Absolutely. It's the most amazing name in history. I mean, it depends what the real question is, what first names did he choose for his children? That's what I'd like to ask Jan Assmann if I ever get a chance.
Hopefully not. Amazing. Richard.
I know. A little bit. You said it. Not... Okay.
No, but Assmann, yeah. If you're a native German speaker, Assmann, I think, is perfectly fine. I think he's the greatest Egyptologist of the 20th century. I mean, hands down. Like he's the man.
Apparently, this reference is a Seinfeld episode as well. So thanks for that, Steve Kerfuffle.
Yes.
Thank you to the 25 people watching right now on Facebook, YouTube, X, and Twitch. We're on all those platforms right now. Do you want to go a little bit longer? Do you have a bit longer?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
All right. We're here.
We got to finish your wine, right? Until you can't speak anymore.
Oh, last person who said that did a 6.5-hour podcast with me. Yeah, no, the last we went after 3 hours of podcasting, myself and esoteric publisher Lenny Peterson of Hermetic Science Enterprises in Edinburgh. After 3 hours of podcasting, we opened up some Robbie Burns scotch and went another 3.5 hours, and that podcast holds the record. So be careful what you wish for with me, because I have a endurance of the Irish and Scottish heritage. And we're having fun. So we may as well finish our wine. And it's great being here with everybody. People are loving. It's an amazing mixture. Us joking about Jan's last name has led to probably many people discovering one of the greatest Egyptologists. So that's a humor for the win once again. Yeah. All right. I did have a question, but we kept making jokes, so I forgot it. Do you have any questions for me? I mean to ask that more on the podcast because sometimes I apparently don't ask that enough, though people never do, so that's okay.
Well, I want to say that first of all, I think that it's probably your audience that the book is for, and so I really want to say I appreciate this as an invitation. I really also wanted to improve the Hermetica as a translation, that is to actually to make it more clear. I won't deny that there are places in the Hermetica where it just appears like gibberish, and one does need to think really seriously about what to do with those passages. And sometimes I will admit that reading through the Hermetica, to my mind, it just doesn't make any sense. And the Hermetic author seems to go from here, there, and everywhere. And admittedly, in some cases, this is due to translation and, you know, coming into Latin, coming into Coptic. The eighth reveals the ninth is itself fragmentary, so there's gaps. But there are some absolutely purple passages in there that are just absolutely timeless. And, like in Corpus Hermeticum 11 at the end, like if you've made it through, like if you've slogged through the tough stuff on Hermetic physics, at the end, there's just this beautiful passage about the absolute omnipresence of your nous and that you're literally everywhere. And, you know,
you can go anywhere and know anything, which.
Right. And live every life. Yeah.
And which I would have thought of as they went to woo woo here, if it wasn't for the fact that recently I had listened to all of the telepathy tapes. So we don't need to get into that, of course, because I know you haven't listened to them all probably. But I do want to say that it was because of them that when I read that passage in the text, I read it from a place of faith and full belief. So that's actually really interesting. Like when I read that passage, I actually believed it. Whereas had I read it before the telepathy tapes, I would have maybe inwardly felt a little tongue in cheek, you know, like this is over. This is speaking, is going a bit too far here, but let's go for it. You know, let's say this is possible. But yeah, now I believe it. I believe it's possible. Yeah. Maybe.
It's actually not rhetorical exaggeration to say that your nous is everywhere because your nous doesn't have a body and it's not normal matter. It is not in space or time. And I think this is really important for understanding how it is that you break out of the cycle of reincarnation, because there seems to be two paths. In the first path, you go through every life, every type of life, literally. You know, you're born in 13th century India, then you're born in 15th century China, and then you're born in, 65,000 years ago in Australia. You know, I'm not going in sequence. And then you're born in 20th century America. But there's another path, and this is a path that the Carpocratians talked about, and they were also big into transmigration. Their point was that you could go through life, not through all those trials. You could go through a single time, one single time, if you knew the powers of your nous. You could experience every single life, every single form of life in one life, if you knew the power of nous. You could be in India. You could live 1,000 lives in India in one life. You could gain all the experience that you would in 1,000 lives in one life if you knew the power of nous. And so I really think that the Hermetist is onto something there, that if you really knew who you are, you would know that you are outside of space and time. So where are you? Nowhere. Yeah, you could be on other planets and other dimensions. In fact, you are. You just don't know it. And that's really, really hard to get your head wrapped around. But it is an absolutely logical deduction from the, you know, fact that your noose is not normal matter. So it's not in the space-time continuum. And this little thing that you call your ego, to which your, you know, your noose is attached by some kind of tether that we don't understand, you know, that's not you exactly. That's not you.
Yeah.
These kids who go through reincarnation and remember various lives, in a sense, I think, even if, you know, I think the lesson to be learned from reincarnation is that, yeah, you don't have to go through that, right? Because going through that, that's like the hard, that's like the hard version. Whereas if you really came to the point of entering, you know, enlightenment in a Buddhist sense, yeah, you wouldn't need to go through all of those lives.
Yeah. I always had a problem. I always had a problem with reincarnation, and people know that because of the way it was explained to me growing up in a Hindu tradition of yoga, and seeing it as a leapfrog always seemed problematic to me. Like we're just gonna, and seemed sort of somewhat terrifying to me. The idea I'm just gonna go through life after life after life, and maybe eventually I'll ascend. But then when it was again, when I heard what really shifted me is I thought I figured it would be, if they did exist, it was more complicated that. And again, it was when I was listening to these autistic kids on the telepathy tapes, and they said regarding reincarnation, no, again, you're out of space-time continuum, like you said. So they aren't past lives or future lives. They're all present. And the autistic kids go so far as to say the things you do in this life can even affect those other lives and vice versa. Right now, which I love that, because I can't conceive it. That's what I love about it, is the fact that I can't wrap my head around it. How is that possible? Because when my sister passed last year, does that mean she's outside of time, space, and so she's already able to experience me after I've died, but at the same time she can experience me now in my presence somehow? Again, the brain just breaks trying to think of these, can hold these contradictions and even a gentle tension. And I love that the hermetists seem to take on these issues. They seem to wrestle with them head on, and they took a different tact than a lot of other people did. What do you say is the most unique and special thing the hermetists brought to the history of human spirituality?
I'm not sure you could reduce it to just one thing, but I always tell people it's very, very important to understand these people as they don't view themselves as original. They view themselves as representing the greatest of the ancient Egyptian tradition. And of course, if you are an Egyptologist, you know, and then you read the Hermetica, you may think that, well, there's nothing similar. But I do think that when you had the combination of that Egyptian priestly mentality and Greek philosophy, it did create this wondrous concoction where they did, I think, for the first time, realize that you had a truly transcendent moment, but that transcendence is so, it's so earthy in these hermetic texts. You know, you are so close to the divine in this world. And, you know, I think that in ancient Egypt, you know, the gods were all on earth, and, you know, people have this sense that, or they were in the sky, and the people have the sense that Platonism makes the gods very distant. But actually what happens in Platonism is, I think, in a sense, it brings the divine even closer than it was to you, because it helps you to realize your own connection to divinity. And I think the Hermetists realized that this was a philosophy that they could exploit while keeping their traditional, emphasis on other things like the powers of gods, the powers of the fates, the influence of divine beings. And transmigration, when you look at ancient Egypt, they don't seem to have that really. But I think, again, the Hermetists of the ancient world were genius, because they knew that the Greeks thought that reincarnation was native Egyptian lore. And so it's sort of like the colonized people embraced that aspect and ran with that in terms of their wisdom tradition, and then presented themselves as the true source for the great insights of Pythagoras and of others like Plato. And they were successful. So to my mind, I think the greatest contribution of Hermetism is just to say that if you look at it, it's like a miracle. But everyone says that, kind of Christianity killed paganism, and like some Christian triumphalists, like they cite the Hermetic Apocalypse as, like Augustine himself did this, as like the death of paganism and the death of Egyptian religion. But the Hermetic writings have ensured that Egyptian spirituality is fused into the bone marrow of anyone doing anything Western or esoteric, right through the medieval period. Hermes was never forgotten. And you'll see that if you read Hermetica 2 in terms of the reception. It's not like, in terms of like, it's not like Hermes got a new lease on life with Ficino. Like, no, not at all.
I used to think so, but yeah. Nope.
Absolutely.
This is all about alchemy, and that you should just reduce it down to the Emerald Tablet. And you, since you just mentioned Hermetica 2, you do address and translate some stuff to do with the Emerald Tablet in Hermetica 2, along with a bunch of stuff from Michael Psellus. So any Solomonic magicians out there, there's a good reason just to get this text for the Michael Psellus stuff alone, who's a very significant figure in our magical history. But can we reduce all of this to alchemy or spiritual alchemy or the Emerald Tablet? And the Emerald Tablet wasn't produced from the Hermetic communities, was it? It's much later, out of Arabic alchemy.
Yeah, like alchemy is not a core feature of the Hermetic literature until you get to the 4th century. It's another way that the Egyptian mind adapts to its circumstances and takes over a new science. Obviously we had seen like something that looked, like interaction of chemicals and transformation of metals, but it's really the 4th century of the Common Era with figures like, Zosimus, where that really, is clearly now part of the Hermetic science. So yeah, I would say again, it's that other indication of the tremendous vibrancy of the Hermetic spirituality, that when new sciences emerge, as alchemy did, that it assumes that and takes that and then becomes the cultural protector and caretaker for that tradition advancing on into time. And so, yeah, no, I wouldn't say it's central, but of course you might, you might have, you might have someone wanting to say that, alchemy gives us the allegorical language, to talk about all sorts of spiritual transformation. So in a sense, even if the science developed later in antiquity, that you can still use the alchemical metaphors to talk about the kind of transformation of mind that we see in the earlier text. that's fine with me. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, so a lot of people who are watching right now have read Hermetica 1, which is great. Hopefully you guys get the Audible audiobook 2 as well of Hermetica 1 and hear my impassionate reading of it, and support Dr. Litwa's work here.
It's a deifying reading.
It's a deifying reading. Thank you.
You're going to literally be taken onto cloud 9 with a reading like that. Yeah.
Well, you know, before each recording session, I rang my bell and I anointed myself with a mercury oil consecrated and handmade by Frater Ashin Chasan, who's very famous and popular in the magical world. And I like to think that all that, including invoking Thoth, all of that had something to do with it. And it was a humbling experience for me, honestly, because a lot of my technical know-how with music recording actually bit me in the behind. When it came to doing a professional audiobook. So that was fun and humbling. And I was like, oh, you figured out a way to humble me even doing something that I should know so well. And I thought that was delightful, if not frustrating, as we know, because it delayed things. But yeah, we got it done. And thanks also to my friend Kesha over in Russia, who did some post-production on the tracks. Evocar Lux on Facebook for those who might want an awesome professional major motion picture quality level audio engineer and sound designer. He's a great guy, so we got to shout him out. Thank you very much, Kesha. Evocar Lux on Facebook. People, check out his work. But when it comes to the fact that I wanted to address the why you're doing all of this. Well, you weren't doing all of this stuff. Not nearly to the extent that you are now, especially your Gnosis Academy, which I'm in, which is a monthly meeting, which is great. The lessons, the classes, all the courses you're putting out. This wouldn't be possible if you were still working full-time through a university, but you aren't working full-time through a university, for better or for worse, and you are making a go at it like many PhDs are these days, increasingly so, as an independent producer of scholarship and learning. And I thought that would be an interesting thing just to hear your thoughts on for people. So, because I think people should know, if we want this to keep going and if we want academics who are doing exactly what we love and enjoy and benefit from, if we want them to be able to keep doing what they're doing outside of the walls of the academy, we do need to support their work. We do need to help, you know, make the economy stronger so that you guys can thrive. And actually this is a pathway forward for people like you to share your work with the communities it directly affects. It's obviously not the same thing as playing the academic game of peer-reviewed papers and tenure tracks and all of that, but it is something I think we should support. I do want people to know that I did this recording for you as a gift, to support you and to help, you know, just, I want you to be as successful as possible so that all of you scholars who are doing the work that I benefit from and that helps me. And so I want people to know that. So I was thinking maybe you could just say something to, you sent out some emails recently talking about this, about the journey of an independent academic such as yourself and what you hope to be able to create and what you've enjoyed about this freedom, this extramural freedom that you have been, given. I don't want to say forced into, but
I have
given.
The freedom. I have the
You've
freedom.
You've been set free. Not, they've set you yeah. free.
I have the freedom not to receive a regular paycheck. And
indeed.
Yes, I have a family. I did not leave the academy of my own will. My wife was not granted permanent residency in the States. So I was forced to leave my job at Boston College. And yeah, I never wanted to be independent, but I'm like a hermetic priest who has lost his job at the local temple. And I have to now go into the city of the World Wide Web and sell my wisdom and hope that I can find a way through kind souls such as Frauder, RC, and many others who will enable me to allow me to fulfill this calling that I have. Literally, I can't fail. I have no other training. You know, it's not like I fall, you know, I can fall back on my engineering or my IT training. You know,
you can't learn to code.
No, I have to do this or starve, or I guess the local grocery store, but then again, they probably wouldn't pay me quite enough to survive. I'd probably have to work nights as well, cleaning toilets or something. But I have endeavored to present my wisdom. And, you know, the economy be damned. I am going to fulfill this vocation. And if I didn't have that deep spiritual sense of fulfilling that vocation, geez, I don't know where I would be. Maybe on the side of a road dead somewhere. I don't know. Like, but this either has to work or nothing, you know, like, yes, the, you know, this isn't like a plea for support. This is an absolute recognition of my vocation and a sense of gratitude that I've made it. For 6 months, I've been completely independent. And, you know, despite people trying to destroy the economy, people such as Frauder, RC, and many others have had my back. And hopefully many of you who have benefited from this literature will continue to help me evolve and find a vocation, find a niche in which I can provide a real service. Because the goal here is yes, we're filling in a massive gap in the educational system. First of all, like I can't afford to be just a dry academic and pretend that none of this matters anymore and pretend that I'm neutral. So we're going to take away that mask. I am still going to give you the best of all scholarship. I am still going to give you the same quality that I would submit for a peer review essay. That's not in question. I'm not reducing the quality. But what I'm making a declaration here with Hermetica One that this isn't going to be another dry and dusty tome about the history and genre of the Hermetica. This is going to be something that matters because it does matter spiritually. It is the Western tradition of spirituality. It is the shining beacon. And so I'm going to combine my knowledge of Greek and the scholarship so that you guys can have this. And then hopefully, you know, the universe will have blessed you so that you can bless me in other ways as well. And I sincerely hope that, you know, many of you will join me in the Gnosis Academy, where, you know, you can get, eventually all my online courses are going to be there, all my online seminars, everything's going to be on that platform. So rather than pay, you know, for each individual course, you just take the Gnosis Academy and then go on a spiritual journey with me. Reach out, give me advice, tell me what is useful to you, and I'll do my best to help out. As I say, just to be clear, like I have exited by force from a formal position in a brick and mortar university, but I have not left scholarship and I have not ceased to be an academic and I have not in any way, shape or form given up on the idea of a vocation of filling in this massive gap of education where, at least if you're in the States, you don't have $30,000 lying around to, you know, go to, you know, get your education in esoteric. And frankly, it's not there. So it's not going to be at your local university. You'd have to travel 2,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 miles even to get something that might even feed
graduate level.
At the graduate level. Yeah.
And that's graduate. There's no undergraduate. There's no undergraduate year-long survey course in esotericism available. anywhere in the world.
Yeah. And even, you know, Harvard has its endowment and, you know, Princeton, they have it, the endowment. They're going
to, they don't have enough to pay you.
Yeah.
They need bigger endowments so they can afford you.
They don't need your donations. I hate to say it, but a lot of the brick and mortar education is a failed system anyway. So they don't need it. Even if they get their, start paying more taxes, they're still going to be fine. You know, they've got enough money to last 100 years. So, you know, be part of the revolution in education. That education which doesn't try to divide spirituality and science. And that's what the Hermetica is. It's that dimension of human experience that says science and spirituality are the exact same thing. Stop dividing them, please.
That's a message I think very appropriate for our time. And having you freed from the university system is a blessing to the world. I think the future is good education, obviously. We are already seeing that in a massive way. And as far as access to a general undergraduate esotericism course goes, for everyone who wishes, they could have taken a year-long esotericism survey course at first-year university. Well, we have an announcement about that this Wednesday, right here from the Arcane Research Society. That is very exciting and exactly that. So stay tuned, people, about that. And you are doing agreed to do a presentation remotely from Australia for the InnokiaCon Arcane Research Society event. And you've said you're going to talk about Gnosis and politics. Do you have any teasers to say on that? Any thoughts on that so far? Or just to tease it a bit about what you might be talking about?
Well, I never trust a politician. You know, the word for politician and demon,
praise the Lord,
is the same word in Greek. It's archon. it does the same duty.
Know that. You know,
they call archons both your local politician and your local demon. So, as much as I would like to be recommending revolution in mayhem, I think that in light of the great political traumas and trials that we're going, I think there is genuinely a Gnostic politics, and it's not Republican or Democrat or liberal or labor, but it is something that I think is worth knowing. And so it'll be an experimental lecture, probably way off topic for the conference, but I'm hoping that it will be useful to people who are just frankly struggling with toxic politics, but are not happy to be quietist.
So kind of a Gnostic antidote to the cacophony of political discourse today.
Yeah. A way to something wade like through that.
And I want to reiterate this again into your face. I think it's eminently on topic because Dee and Kelly, their whole lives were defined by politics. The messages the angels and other spiritual creatures had for them were extremely political. And yeah, their lives and deaths were formed by, like, they had to make fake diary entries to show to papal nuncios sent to Prague to try and trick them into coming to Rome. So they had to show them fake diary entries of fake interactions with spirits. And we today had to parse out which of those entries were fake and shown to the nuncios and which were real ones. And that's just why we have conferences now on this stuff, because there's so much more to it than scholars and biographers, polemical biographers, initially wanted people to think. And so I think what you're going to be talking about is extremely on point. And in fact, fuses the significance of what Dee and Kelly and Elizabethan England at the founding of the British Empire. You got to remember, John Dee coined the term British Empire and said to Elizabeth, he said, "You are going to be the queen who initiates a global empire," of course. And that happened. A lot of the things Dee and the spirits that, you know, a lot of that stuff sort of came true. So that's very interesting. And the role of gnosis in politics, I mean, yeah, let's hear about it. I can't wait. So anyone interested, it'll be enochiacon.com. You can go check that out. But yeah, I'm glad you're doing well and that you're surviving doing this. It would be the most tremendous loss to us, I think, if you weren't able to keep being available to us. And but as you've said, what else would you do, especially at this stage in your academic career? And you have so many books published by, I don't know many academics, honestly, who put out the amount of peer-reviewed Cambridge-published material as you have in the last 10 years since you got your doctorate. Like, you, for those curious, Dr. Litwa here didn't go through the traditional MA route. You went through the MDiv and then the THM route, correct? That's, I have that correct, don't I? So you went Master of Divinity. We graduated the same year with our Masters of Divinity in 2006. Then you did the THM, which I didn't do, though I might still, who knows. And then you did the PhD. And of course, you got to study at Duke, which is cool. So we actually might know some professors in common because a bunch of Duke people used to come to Vancouver School of Theology at UBC. There's a question here I don't think is relevant, but we'll put it on the screen since it's the first formal question. The Book of Oaspi, have you heard of this? That's a Greek word, clearly. I don't know.
I haven't. Are you familiar with
Book of Oaspi? No. All right. Sorry. Good shot, though. If there was someone to ask, it would be someone like David here. And yeah, I think at this point, the M may as well stand for Magus. Well, your mother wouldn't be pleased with that, though, would she?
I'll grow into that. Yeah, I don't know what the end of the story will be, but yeah,
your biography could be called From Matthew to Magus.
Oh, hopefully not.
Nice triple entendre. Okay, well, hopefully you'll outlive me so I can't write it. This has been such a delight. If there's any last questions, people, shoot them out now if you have any last questions, because we can't do this forever. But it's been great that you've been willing to spend so much time with us here, and maybe we can do a long form podcast sometime in the future. A formal question for fun. Here is the formal question for fun. All right, we got an official question here. Spiritualism text of 1882, very fascinating link, how it could relate to Gnostic and Hermetic thought. Oh, no, wait, that's the second part. So that was the wrong one. I hit the wrong button. Could the noetic light be viewed as a sense organ that is only awakened in the Hermetic initiate? Could that also be the medium of communication of pure Platonic forms? Interesting. Interesting. I don't know. That's for you for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, keep that on the screen, actually. Can you? But yeah, that's a very... it's a good one. It's very, very profound. I think Rudy,
you are Goldman 23.
You're thinking. I mean, you're really thinking deeply on this topic, which is exactly what you should be. I mean, is it an organ? Like, it is at least analogous to an organ, where the Hermetic author referred to the eyes of your nous, or the eyes of your heart, which is actually a phrase that gets repeated in Ephesians. It's in Christianized. So it's at least analogous to an organ, but it's like an organ that is not really yours. It's a non-material organ. So, yeah, the great debate in the Hermetica is whether everyone has nous, or whether it's something that you get, and they never quite resolve that one. And so I can't, you know, there would be no straight answer to this one. I would like to think that everyone has it and that it could be awakened, but maybe not according to Corpus Hermeticum 4. But that would be independent from the second part of your question. Could it be the medium of the communication of pure Platonic forms? It would certainly be the medium of perceiving everything that was happening in the eighth and ninth realm. It's interesting that the Hermetic authors never really talk about forms. there is really a ceiling in the universe that is the ninth realm. And what's going on there is it's a bunch of powers who are singing. And apparently that's our destiny. That's the highest we can get, to become a power of God that's singing. And I hope that's not depressing to anyone. I mean, I think that can be quite profound and contemplative, singing as a form of meditation. The song is silent, but that's apparently what your noose does. So anyway, yeah, but your question cracks open a lot of things. And even if it's not exactly in line with hermetic material, I think it's in line with broader esoteric trends that, of course, the hermetist is only, hermetic thought is only kind of one branch that gives its own particular and peculiar answers. But those of us who are studying multiple esoteric paths might want to think more broadly about general patterns, which is exactly the kind of thing that you're raising. So thank you. That's a very profound question.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. And thanks for everyone who's tuned in. I've only had this many live watchers one other time with Jason Louv, and he's on Netflix, so hard to compete with that. Of course, I'm sure we'll get you on there sooner or later. You know, first we have to get you on Gaia. Can you handle that? I don't know. That's a that's probably not a thing in the cap of an academic to be on Gaia. But it's where a lot of the audience is, especially your audience, and the best antidote to bad speech is good speech. Is that what they say? Something like that. I don't know. But the you know, when you have people like talking about the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, that's the silly one, right? Yeah, the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. You need someone to come in and be like, I think you mean the Emerald Tablets of Hermes, because this other one's not quite so legit. And let's talk about it. You know, they need people like you. And apparently they probably pay well. So anyway, here's another question. Someone has a question that's really, really dead on. Oh, that's not this one. I hit the wrong button. There we go. Someone says, any advice on learning how to pronounce the vowels that should be vibrated and how long they should be vibrated during one of the prayers? Sorry, I can't remember the section it's from. Well, I have the section right here, of course. And I would like to say, I'm glad you said this. Thank you very much, Christian Simons. Because so when I got to that part of having to record it for Audible, I could have approached it from several directions. I decided to get the advice of a modern native Greek speaker. So I talked to Dr. Sasha Chato. She did some recordings for me. Then I emulated them as best I could. There's two things I intentionally didn't want to do. I didn't want to superimpose my own interpretation on it in two ways. I didn't want to use the sounds that I would say as a Western speaker, which is why I asked a native Greek speaker. Because even the tone of a vowel sound, even if you're using the International Phonetic Alphabet, is going to be a little bit different. And that's something, fortunately, as a musician and singer, I am sensitive to. So I really tried the sounds I made when I did the vowels and did the magic word, shall we say. The magic words, there's a couple magic words. I can't quite remember them by heart, how I said them then. And in my own practice, I say them differently. And I wanted to avoid doing it the way I do it as a Golden Dawn magician, because there's a certain vibratory method we use. And though that's what I personally think should be done, I didn't want that to be superimposed into the text itself. So I did something more middle of the road. I split the difference. And I think the result might be not as powerful as a magical performance as I could have done as a singer on that, in that section with the vowels and holding them for different lengths of time. Also, I'm not a native Greek speaker, so did I nail the sounds the way she said them exactly? Absolutely not. And I thought it would be more important to show a flawed attempt to reproduce them in a certain way than to overconfidently do them in a very convicted way. I didn't want to give people the idea that this is how it should be done. I wanted them to hear hesitance or imperfection. I wanted the listener to hear that, because I think that is the right way to communicate that knowledge, with sort of a sense of, I don't really know what the perfect way to do this is, and probably neither do you, but here you go, do what you can with it. That was the vibe I wanted in that very little point of the text, right? That's a very, very important part of the liturgy of the text, wouldn't you say?
Well, sure. Yeah. You, in order to ascend you through the planets, you speak in the language of the planets, and the planets are producing a sound on an octave, essentially a harmonic sound. So you need to presumably get that right. I'm not sure if Frauder can share this, but there's an important article by Christian Bull called Monkey Business, Magical Vowels and Cosmic Levels. I've shared it in the chat with Frauder. If you can get your hand on that, Christian might have that on academia.edu. That's a nice article in which he throws a lot of light on this, as speaking in the language of the vowels actually isn't about speaking Greek or even Egyptian. It's about baboonic. It's the language of the baboons. And of course, the baboon is an avatar of Hermes Thoth. And Egyptian baboons do speak vowel sounds at sunrise. And so it's an interesting take. I'm not sure if it will help in your practice, but in terms of getting some of the historical background, I really recommend it.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Indeed.
All right. Just got a couple little lovely comments from people. Yeah, so the vowel thing is interesting. I don't think I actually noticed the baboon article you're talking about from Bull. I might have missed that somehow, and I wish I hadn't. Oh, well. Anyway, but the we'll have to dig into that again. Here's one of your fellows from the Gnosis Academy, which I really want to encourage people to join. You get to hang out with me every month, along with David here, and along with Mr. S. Mill. Thank you, Sean, for the comment. Sean says, Dr. Sean, is a chemist, says, Wouter Honegraaff has an MP3 of a musician friend doing the vowels of the 8th and the 9th. Maybe the same file Sasha used. No, Sasha did her own thing. She did her own little recording for me based on a native Greek speaking, as growing up speaking Greek. And that's what I thought that would be a good way to approach that, to avoid sort of controversy, and also just to, you know, give people a starting point. It was the one part of the text I didn't want to give the impression of having sort of any competent or even confident mastery of whatsoever, because I thought that it was such an important part of the text that it really needs to, people need to meet it halfway rather than be like, oh, that's how Frater RC did it on the audio. You know, I didn't want people trying, my nightmare would have been people trying to do it exactly as I did it. So I wanted it to be just bad enough that people would be like, no, I can do this better, because yes, you can. And it will be different from how I do it better, because I do it better on my own, not the same way as I did it on the audiobook. I do this whole Golden Dawn vibratory breathing thing, and you know, that's what works for me, and that's part of my tradition. But you got to maybe make it part of your tradition. Honegraaff also addresses sort of a antiphon call and response with the omega sound. that isn't addressed in your text. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, well, there are various theories about the Omega. Okay, it's on Academia. Yeah, I think both Bull and Honegraaff talk about that. I'm not sure that the antiphonal stuff can be proved, but there's a question about, is that there's a sequence of long omegas at the end, and omegas also are interspersed at different points. And so obviously you have Hermes and Tot there. So is Hermes giving the alphas and the omicrons, and Ta is bringing in the omegas? We don't know. But yeah, I'm not sure. A lot of that will be educated guesswork, so take it as it is. It's not, we don't have a sound recording from antiquity, unfortunately, but we do know at least that the Egyptian priests did this for many, many thousands of years. And it was lovely, that it was actually very aesthetically pleasing.
It's probably no surprise to hear that I've been, obviously struggling with ever since Honegraaff put out his book, I've been, did his presentation, I've been wrestling with how will I record this? Because I want to record this, of course. And I want to record it with voices, but I also want to record it with instruments in a way and integrate some of the theory of it into some music. And it's a really interesting topic. I hope more people keep talking about it. I know there's groups in South America engaging in this practice while on ayahuasca to purge the bad daimones from their bodies, which is a theory on what might have been going on to some extent, right? It's really cool to see this spirituality taking root in modern day, I think. I mean, how thrilled are you by that? And what do you expect the next sort of couple years of hermetic research might look like, especially with the possible release of Wildberg's thing? You and he had some very interesting, have some very interesting disagreements on where the astrology and the animal stuff in the text might begin and end, right? And so there's quite a few little nuances and debates there to be had. Do you think you'll ever get to talk to him about this stuff? And I guess we can't really say much until his book is done and out, right?
Yeah, I'll say something just briefly on that. And then, unfortunately, I have to run. But
absolutely.
Yeah, we don't know when that book is coming out. But one thing that we do know is that book is not going to be friendly to practitioners. That book, in fact, Wildberg has made clear in his already published work that he doesn't see any steps of initiation in this material. And so his paradigm is completely different. And that, yes, the effect of his work will be to de-astrologize the material.
Entirely.
Almost entirely. That he thinks that all of that is later layers that just need to be peeled off as glosses. So we're still waiting for that tidal wave. I don't know when it's coming, but I actually, among practitioners, I don't think that, I think that there might be a little bit of a shock, but ultimately, I don't think, from what I've seen, that Wildberg will be able to convince actual hermeticists.
Well, I think certainly not since you've sort of put in and put your work out there. I think you've inoculated us to a certain extent against the tide of that's coming from Wildberg's work. So that's, at the very least, there's going to be pushback now and debate, whereas there might have been without your work. For example, say you just stayed working on, you were doing the the gospel texts, a lot of work on the gospel passages, which when I heard about it, I was like, oh man, I would have been so into that if I had stayed as a preacher in the Anglican Church. That what you were doing there was like really valuable work for any clergy. But you're not doing that anymore. And so instead you've done this, and it's served to give us a bit of a bulwark against the coming criticism of this spirituality. And that will be very interesting. And I think we owe you a tremendous debt for that, to unlock as best as anyone can the spiritual core of Hermetic thought and spirituality. And I just want to say thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, from the depths of my soul to my highest nous. My holy diamond hopefully is talking, hanging out with your holy diamond right now, and they're having a little dance to celebrate this wonderful great work that you've done. So thank you so much. Thank you everybody for listening here tonight and joining us at this late night hour, or early morning for you in the world. I mean, there usually isn't early mornings and late nights anymore in the global internet world, right? It's someone's coffee time somewhere and someone's happy hour somewhere. So someone just says one last thing, last comment for the road, doctor. As someone who speaks classical Greek, I often wonder, is the precise pronunciation of omega in ritual a hierophantic obligation? I'm from South America. There we go. Thank you, Manuel Casanueva.
I think only the planet Saturn or Kronos could answer that question, because that's his vowel. Ultimately, he's the arbiter of that.
So, Manuel, have a chat with Kronos when you go to bed tonight, and please do let us know. Please do let us know. Shoot us a message. And please, everyone, join Dr. Litwa's Gnosis Academy. Hang out with me and him and everyone else there once a month. Join his Greek class, which honestly, the Greek class is just as fun as your Gnosis Academy, because like when you signed off, we were reading the Life of Pythagoras on Wednesday. You left you let us keep talking after you left. And I think we talked for an hour and a half, those of us who hung up behind. I don't know if you noticed that when you shared the recording.
No.
Okay. So we said a lot of stuff. We just went for it and just talked and hung out for an hour and a half after you left and had a great time getting to know each other. Yeah, right? Well, that's that. It was such a sign of the organic emergence of a community. I was like, oh, this is how communities happen. Yeah, this is how this happens. So I wanted to let you know that in case you didn't. Like, well done. You are building a great community. YouTube has allowed you, when you started your YouTube long after mine, and when it was smaller than mine, I was so nervous. I was like, oh dear God, please don't let this guy be another one who gets just throttled by the algorithm and stuff like that. And of course, I know none of us are making money on views, but I was just worried that you, due to your content, you wouldn't get to grow. And the fact that your channel has gotten to grow and like lap many others many times, it's a really great success. I'm sure it might not seem as big as you would want it or as you'd expect or hope for, but it is doing well. In my opinion, it's doing extraordinarily well from someone who, you know, is somewhat arguably Shadowbrand. And so thank you for the building these communities and building these bridges for us all. And it's going to be great to have you be a part of my ongoing continuing education for the next years. So please, everyone, join any of his courses. And you just added the Nag Hammadi to the Gnosis Academy with Nag Hammadi 2, the course Nag Hammadi 2.
Part 2,
yeah. You've got a whole course on Nag Hammadi, course on Nag Hammadi 2, a course on the Hermetica. It's so amazing how much work you've done, all the books you've written. I think you're a rock star. God bless. May Thoth have send you many blessings and all of that. So thank you very much. And everyone here in the chat is echoing my praise and thanks. Yes, absolutely.
Thank you all. Yes. Amazing that you're even here. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We are here. We are here and we are we're alive. So thanks for being here. Thanks everyone for watching. We're going to shut things down now because obviously this was only supposed to be a half an hour, but fortunately I did my job well and was interesting enough to keep my esteemed guest on far past the time he expected. expected. That's what we do here on Magic Without Fears Hermetic Podcast. So thank you everyone for making this a fun time for David and me. So I'll see you Wednesday at class talking about Pythagoras. Yeah, absolutely. Look, other people should do it too. All right, everybody, thank you very much. You just leave your screen open once we close this so that the audio uploads properly, if you don't mind. So people go check out Hermetica One now on Audible. Go listen to it, give it a good review, and promote David's work and get this out there so that the first 2 weeks is crucial for rankings in the Amazon and Audible algorithms. So please do that, and we'll catch you all soon. Thank you very much. Peace.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Diving deep into the practices and reality tunnels of the esoteric and the occult, check out Praxis Behind the Obscure podcast, where I interview practicing occultists, do book reviews, and much more. Check us out on YouTube, Red Circle, and many other podcast platforms.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a six-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.